Back together again, you and I chatting it up midweek Wednesday style, February 18th, 2026, right here on Connecticut Today, where we welcomed Greenwich Stamford GOP State Rep Tina Corpus to the show regarding a public hearing that was held the previous day on another controversial housing bill. Hearst Connecticut Media senior editor and columnist Dan Haar talked about another new controversy over the continued sale of Aquarion Water. CBS News legal analyst Thane Rosenbaum discussed Meta CEO Mark Zuckerberg's testimony earlier in the day at a key social media trial and court case. And I also had a few thoughts on a proposed Connecticut so-called climate superfund. So we're talking about Senate Bill SB 151, which I am shocked was introduced in an election year. But what do I know? So there was a big public hearing on this yesterday. Real convenient, middle of the day on a Tuesday after a holiday weekend. I'm shocked. Joining us right now with her thoughts is Republican State Rep Tina Corpus. She represents District 149, Greenwich and Stamford, two communities, obviously, with deep interest in this bill. She's also a member of the General Assembly's Housing Committee, and I think this is maybe her first visit here, if I'm not mistaken. Hey, Tina, it's Paul. Good afternoon. How are you?
Fine, thank you, Paul. Yes, it's my first visit. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, great for the time, Tina. We appreciate it. So, what did you think yesterday? I find this interesting because even the supporters say, well, this is not about affordable housing. This is about, you know, some of this zoning and land use and square footage that we don't agree with. What are your thoughts coming off of what you may have heard yesterday?
Well, you stated it perfectly. You know, after 6 hours of public hearing and 84 people testifying and over 100 pieces of written testimony, some of the most fundamental questions, the fundamental questions of this bill are still unanswered, which is there's no guarantee that even with the negative byproducts, which I think are many in this bill, that we will actually end up with more affordable housing in Connecticut. And that is an enormous flaw. We also don't have any answers to the fundamental question of how is this going to work? How do you, by densifying Connecticut's towns in the subdivisions contemplated by this bill, how do you support that? How do you support that from the perspective of parking, sewer, water, schools, roads, fire, police? And, you know, after 6 hours, none of those questions are still answered. And that is obviously very problematic.
And one of the main, Tina, sponsors of this bill, Martha Marks, state Senate member, Democrat, who chairs, I believe, housing. She said, well, this is for starter homes. And all right, I understand that theory, not so much from our generation here, but from my parents and grandparents' generation. Well, Tina, look, I'm no expert in zoning or any sort of real estate, but if you carve up these residential areas further with the quest of putting starter homes on there, there's no guarantee that even those starter homes are going to be affordable. I mean, developers are developers. They're businessmen and women, right?
That's right. And I have this issue with the way we approach housing policy here in the state of Connecticut. And it was interesting to me yesterday. Some of the proponents of the bill, legislators, cited a CBIA, which is our main business organization, cited a CBIA study which yep. said the most significant block, if you will, of businesses coming to Connecticut is lack of housing. And that was sort of quoted out there in the, in the public domain yesterday. But I pulled up that report, and what it says as solutions to fixing that is really not what this bill does. The solutions to fixing that are lowering taxes, lowering regulations, red tape, and fees on businesses to attract them to come here, lowering electric rates to make the state more affordable, and doing all of the things that holistically make the price of housing go down. You know, the construction costs in Connecticut are really high. We make it very difficult mm-hmm. for people to do business here and to build here. And so to take one slice of the housing equation that is zoning and think that this is going to fix that affordability problem is, it just doesn't work, in my opinion.
Yeah, and Tina, you may have people that you know in the business too, but I have people I know that are real estate agents, and I was talking to one of them a couple of months ago, and she told me that it is a battle when it comes down to, getting a yes from the seller and getting a yes from the buyer once the subject of, as you said, property taxes are discussed. And she's had, she said, more than one client in order to close a sale. The seller has had to come down 10, 20, 30 grand to get the buyer to say yes because of the onerous property taxes here. That's a major problem.
It is a major problem. You know, I have an interesting district because I have a third of Greenwich mm-hmm. and then a part of the city of Stamford.
Yeah.
So I have a suburban town and a city, you know, big city in Connecticut terms. And when I am with my constituents in North Stamford, they are really upset about their property tax increases mm-hmm. in Stamford. Less so in Greenwich, although we just had a property assessment, which may, you know, really rankle people in town come the July 1 bill.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, that is a big issue. And you can't get that under control unless you decrease some of the burdens that we're putting on towns. And, you know, when you look at SB 151, which hasn't passed, and I hope doesn't pass, in conjunction with, you know, 8002, which did pass in the special session in November. This is a lot of burden on towns and a lot of burden, especially the 8002. And you can't staff that. You can't do that work. You can't fulfill those unfunded mandates unless you raise property taxes. That's the only lever municipal governments have.
Yeah, and
you're absolutely right.
Yeah, and Tina, you mentioned this earlier with this, and that's great. Okay, you bring other people into a neighborhood and into a town. Well, police, fire, students, capacity at the elementary schools, capacity at the high schools, all the special ed money. I mean, is anybody who, and I know you can't get into their minds, but is anybody who supports this bill, have they taken a logical look at all those other ancillary things you mentioned?
Well, you know, I'm sure that I know that the intentions are good behind this bill, but, mm-hmm. you know, as a freshman legislator, I was first elected in 2024, and I have a, you know, my career was in the private sector, in corporate law and banking. And so this is a new world for me in some ways. And, yeah.
Really? Come on, Tina, how many times do you roll your eyes? I'm kidding. You don't have to answer that.
Well, I mean, the truth is it's an absolute privilege to do this
sure,
work.
Sure, yeah.
But you know, when one thing I think is really missing from the legislative equation is that everyone, or not everyone, you know, legislators have their little view of the world or their thing that they want to get done or their, you know, soapbox or their issue. But no one, or we don't look enough at the big picture.
Yeah.
Like, okay, yeah, I want my children, when they come of age, to be able to come and back and live in starter homes of the community they grew up in.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I want to retire into a house. You know, I want to be able to afford Connecticut for the rest of my life.
Yeah.
Yes, I want there to be no homeless on the street. Like, of course we all want these things, but that's not the job. The job is not to get up on a soapbox and advocate for what, you know, you specifically think it is right. The job is more to solve problems, taking all of these issues into account. And I think that big picture is often lacking. How are we going to pay for it? How are we going to support all these starter homes or subdivisions? You know, how are we going to get down the street with a fire truck if there's no parking required, you know, off street? So I think sometimes people often, surprisingly often, in my opinion, people lose the forest for the trees in the legislature.
Final question, Tina. Look into your crystal ball, because I know every legislator has one on their desk or, you know, in the car or whatever. Does this even come up for a vote, or is this, I don't know, I said it sounded to me kind of like a little bit of red meat, like, hey, we hear you guys and gals on the progressive left. We love you. We'll put this up. But in an election year, Tina, can you see this coming up for a vote? I can't. I'd be shocked. But then again, who knows?
I don't know the answer to that. You know, anything is possible. But I do think, you know, two things. Like, a lot of political capital was spent in kind of all directions last year on housing. It took up a lot of airtime in the legislature. So, you know, the ink's not even dry on 8002. So it's a big push to do something else, which, by the way, footnote, has not even been clearly laid out how that fits together with a housing bill. 151, it's not clear to me how it fits together with the housing bill we passed. So that's number one. And number two, even if it if it is a sort of throwing spaghetti at a wall, or if it is a bill that really is going to have legs, either way,
yeah.
you know, it erodes the public trust in the system
yeah.
when we are putting stuff out there that's not fully baked or fully thought through. So I don't think it's a good way to make policy either way.
All right, Republican State Rep. Tina Corpus, that's District 149, Greenwich, part of Greenwich and part of Stamford, and she is a member of the Housing Committee. Tina, thank you. Appreciate it. You got the phone number now, so don't hesitate to contact us when you want to get your voice on the air. Appreciate it.
Thanks so much, Paul. Thanks for having me. Take
All
care.
Right, Tina, thanks. Yeah, every time, every Wednesday, right around this time, quarter past five, give or take a minute. It's my show. I can be off by a little bit. Dan Hard joins us, senior columnist and editor, Hearst Connecticut Media. He's been sniffing around the week for the biggest stories. One that could now, and I noticed this last night, could shake out to affect the governor's race. We'll get to that one in a second. But first, Dan, good afternoon. How are you?
Good afternoon. I want my whole 12 minutes.
Yeah, you listen, buddy. You got sure. it, pal.
Sure, it's nothing to you whether you come on at 5:15 or 17. It's 2 minutes.
I'll have my office manager get back to you. Hey, we're still talking at some level, Dan, about this Aquarian sale or not, or the intricacies behind this. Talk about this for my audience here once again.
Yeah, one of the reasons we're still talking about it is that the opponents of it don't seem to understand that Judge Budzik's ruling rejecting the Pura rejection, not overturning because they sent it back to Pura, does not leave a whole lot of room for Pura to reject it a second time.
Yeah.
If Pura rejects it a second time, then we're into farce comedy territory. Because the judge was pretty clear, and what he said was, I'm remanding this case back to you to clarify conditions for the public representative, the ombudsperson, whatever. It's the Office of the Consumer Advocate within the new entity called Aquarian Water Authority.
Yeah.
Right? He did not say that you can go reconsider these issues. He considered the issues and said, no, sorry, the grounds upon which you rejected this merger are not valid because the legislature had already approved those very that very framework.
Mm.
Right. And so into that comes two events. And the first one is that yesterday Eversource, well, really AWA, not Eversource, and the Regional Water Authority sent the same offer to the towns that opposed them and all the towns that they had sent in October before Pura ruled in an attempt to get a settlement.
Huh. Now,
why would they do that?
Well, yeah, this whole thing, Dan, is, and you lay it out as best you can, but what are the, let's backtrack a little bit, because this has been going on for months now. What do towns and cities see, some of them, as the pros and cons of the Aquarian sale? Because I read where some people say, hey, this is actually good, and there are some people that say, no, this is the worst thing that can happen. What is it on the edge of here?
The big con is that you, and I don't mean a con as in a con job.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean the big problem with this is that you no longer have a state or any real, you don't have any break on how much they can charge.
Mm-hmm.
They can charge whatever they want because in the history, this is what the towns believe because as you know, this is going to be, each town is going to have one, each of the 60 towns, or I think it's 59, is going to have one representative on a sort of an oversight board.
Okay.
It's not the board of trustees that runs the company. It's an oversight board.
Yeah.
And the oversight board is going to have the ability to accept or reject rate hikes. But in practice, these are amateur town volunteers like you and me, and they're not going to outsmart the professional utility accountants who come and say, you know, razzle dazzle, we need money because of, So what I said in my column is you need to have these people that are volunteers from the towns be highly trained and able to understand this stuff so they don't get snowed by the executives. So that's the first problem. And the second problem they have is that they don't feel that they have proper representation on the overall board with AWA/RWA. That is the Aquarian Towns versus the Regional Water Authority. That's a little bit of an exotic question. But the Democrats in the legislature largely, it was bipartisan, but it was largely the Democrats in the legislature that approved it.
Yeah.
And now you have Jonathan Steinberg from Westport, who seems to raise a bill. He hasn't said anything publicly, but there is the framework of a bill. You know how it works, where they have the ability to raise an idea first and then, well, we'll give you the language later, but this is just, you know, to meet the deadline. It seems to open the door to reject that approval from 2024.
Wow. Interesting. Dan Haar with us from Hearst Connecticut Media. And then I see, and I'm glad you included this in our little appearance today. I saw this, late yesterday, something's going on in New Britain. And immediately I saw this and I went, oh boy, this is close to, well, we're not going to infer anything here, Aaron Stewart. So what's going on in the great city of New Britain?
Well, it appears to be, and by the way, I just want to say that this mess with Aquarion reflects the broader mess that's happening with utility regulation in Connecticut.
Yeah.
And the state has just simply got to get its hands around that.
Yeah.
But getting to New Britain quickly, the tax collector, who I think is Cheryl Bogoslowski, that's the tax collector. I haven't personally reported. The announcement didn't name her as being the one who is suspended, but it said the tax collector, and that is the tax collector, happens to be a person who is very close to Aaron Stewart.
Mm.
And Aaron Stewart, as you know, is first of all, Aaron Stewart appointed her multiple times as the tax collector.
Mm-hmm.
She inherited her as the tax collector because she had previously run for the office. Her sister, it appears that her sister is the former mayor who was one of the four people killed in the New Britain, I'm sorry, in the Newington lottery killings in 1998.
Oh, my God. Yeah, I remember that. Oh.
I believe that's her sister. But again, I haven't confirmed that. I'm pretty sure that is who it is. I looked it up and it appears that that's the case. But in any case, regardless, Aaron Stewart is running as a person who knows how to, you know, cleanly and effectively and efficiently run a government.
Mm-hmm.
And this is not going to look good for her.
Has the campaign that you've seen, Dan Haar, or the campaign or her, has any counter statement been made on this? Any damage control or not?
No. And let's be clear, Aaron Stewart has in no way, shape, manner, or form been implicated in any wrongdoing, knowledge, anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
And so nor has Cheryl Bogoslowski, because it doesn't name her. Every media outlet has named her, but it says the tax collector, and she is the tax collector.
Yeah.
So I haven't seen any indication that it isn't her, but again, who's suspended. But this is an investigation. Ms. Bogoslowski has not been accused of wrongdoing. Actually, I stand corrected. I've never seen or rarely seen an announcement of someone being suspended on suspicion of X that's so specific. It says years of malfeasance.
Yeah, I saw that.
And it's like, I've been doing this a long time.
Yeah.
And I've covered a lot of people being suspended for this, that, and the other thing. And it's usually just this sort of broad, vanilla, you know, suspended on suspicion of something.
Yeah, sure.
You know, I had a case that went to the state Supreme Court in way back in the 80s where the Board of Ed of the town of Suffield said that a principal was suspended.
Yeah.
And it specifically said not on suspicion of sexual impropriety.
Oh, wow.
And it turned out that that's precisely what it was. They had lied outright.
Jeez.
They specifically said not on suspicion. And it took 6 years to finally get that out of FOI, but by then everybody had forgotten the story.
Hey, so. Dan, that's like, and you covered sports, right? That's like when an athlete, they sign a contract, right? Man, it wasn't about the money. And what's the old phrase, Dan? When they say it's not about the money, it's about the money. Yes, absolutely. Hey, finally, in about the minute we have left, boy, the first congressional district of which you are a constituent, It's getting more and more interesting, is it not, up there?
I can't decide whether to be a Republican or a Democrat this year because I really want to vote in both primaries of the Republican governor's race, which we assume that there's still going to be a primary, but who knows after this news. But and then, of course, the first district. What's going on there is that Luke Bronin has outraised John Larson in both quarters. And that means that it doesn't mean that he's, you know, the front runner, because Larson still has virtually every elected official behind him. Mm-hmm. And Luke has groups like the College Democrats, which is not nothing, but it's, you know, it's not nothing. So I would say that Larson is still the front runner, but Luke is a very, very serious candidate with, get this, $1.5 million on hand as of January 1st. And by the way, I think it's a two-person race because the other two candidates have raised in the neighborhood of $50,000 or $100,000, which makes them not serious candidates. And we can talk about how they're valid and they're both legitimate people with platforms and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. And that's all great. You ain't got no money, you ain't in the party. So, you know,
That's all money. It is. Dan Harhurst, Connecticut Media. Dan, thanks. And we'll check in next week. Be good, man.
That's the theme of this. It's not about the money.
And so, yeah. Well, again, when they say it's not about the money, it's about the money.
Not about the money.
Thanks, Dan. Appreciate it. All right, there you go. You may have heard in our top of the hour and bottom of the hour updates from CBS. Hey, there's a big trial going on, another one involving social media. And you may recognize the name, Mark Zuckerberg, the big boss there at Meta. And again, this all weaves into what Meta knew, when did they know it, is their product or are their products knowingly able to harm young people, are they addictive, all this in the courtrooms being bandied about. Our buddy Thane Rosenbaum, legal analyst, CBS News, chiming in on this, see what he saw today. Thane, it's Paul. How are you, sir?
Great hearing your voice always, Paul.
Thanks, Thane. Appreciate the time. Okay, a lot of people may say, well, all right, yeah, I kind of understand what's going on in this case, but give us the exact positions of both the defense and the prosecution here and the plaintiffs and what is going on here.
You know, it's sort of interesting, Paul. This case is a mirror image, in a way, of the case against Big Tobacco. And you'd say, how can that have anything to do with that? And it does. Because the argument on Big Tobacco was that it's not just the tobacco, it's the nicotine.
Mm.
That's what you did. You rigged the cigarette to take advantage of mental processes of our species that would make it a compulsion. And that's what you did. And that's what makes this dangerous. That's what the argument was. It's the nicotine, not the cigarette. And here's the analogy. It's the algorithm, not the content, right? So up until now, we were told that Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act gives social media companies absolute legal immunity for the third-party content that puts on their site, as if to say, we're just a bulletin board. That's all we do. And people put stuff on their site, on our site, and, you know, we're not responsible for what they put on their site.
Yeah.
So in all these congressional testimonies, Zuckerberg and the other chieftains of these big internet companies, that's what they've said. They said, look, you can't touch us. What makes this case unusual, different, and makes them vulnerable is that they're saying this is not about the content. This is about what your computer scientists are doing to the minds of our kids.
Mm.
That you have created a algorithm, that you have penetrated what they want, and you know how to play to their compulsions. So you know that this toy that you made, that's either a phone or a desktop, that they'll sit on it for 16 hours. The more they sit on it, the more advertising you can sell, because the more people that use it, the better it is. You're profiting off of our kids, and you're exposing them to depression, suicidal thoughts, bad body images, predatory adult predators. You've exposed them because you know they can't leave the device, because you keep feeding them the thing they want. And so that's what made this. So you have a woman who's now in her 20s, but has said, I started on social media at 6, and I'm a mess.
Oh.
You know, I'm a mess. And she says, I've been on for 16 hours a day since I was 6. And I am a mess. And so she's a representative of essentially 1,500 other people that are waiting. They have their own lawsuits against Instagram. And that's a lot of people around the country that are sitting around waiting, because this is the first time a social media company has been exposed to a trial like this, right? That this is a trial. And again, where Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act probably won't help them, because this goes to something different. It goes to the product design, right? It's not the content. It's the design of your machinery. Your the platform itself is designed. And you know it, Mr. Zuckerberg.
Wow.
Your computer scientists know it. You know what you're doing.
So finally, Thane, does what you just laid out, and it eminently understandable, knowing that you've likened that to the amount of nicotine that was adjusted in cigarettes and now the algorithm, does that then neutralize, if I was an attorney for Meta or Facebook or Mr. Zuckerberg, if I said, well, wait a minute, the millions of people consume alcohol in this country and around the world. Yes, some people develop to become, sadly, alcoholics, but there are 90-something percent or more who can use our product responsibly. Would that be an argument or not?
Well, it could be, but again, think about the tobacco.
Yeah.
They're saying, you know, people smoke cigarettes. The case of the tobacco was the nicotine. It wasn't the cigarette, right? You can make a cigarette without the nicotine, but you knew not to do that because you wanted people to buy a lot of packs.
Every
time they go, I need more than one pack. So I guess the alcohol doesn't have the same analogy. The social media has the analogy, except for one thing. Zuckerberg is saying, he said it today, he's going, are you kidding me? First of all, you're the parents. You have to be responsible for how much you're watching your kids. I have kids, too. I'm worried about them, too. I get it. I understand what's possible. But I have all kinds of age verifications. I have certain accounts that you can't open if you're under a certain age. It's not like I don't do anything.
Okay.
I'm trying my best to make sure I'm not. Or you want me to make it like in you know, you may know this, but Australia just passed a law that basically said no social media for kids, period. It's not up to the parents. We don't trust anybody. Can't use it. So he's saying, as long as this is legal, I'm going to put out this product. I'm going to try to do what I can to protect your kids. But in the end of the day, if they're on 16 hours a day, then something's wrong in their house that you're not getting them to away from their phone and their desktop. But one thing that you can know for sure, this has huge consequences.
Oh, my God.
Remember, they thought they had immunity. This case might explode into a giant judgment. This could result in tens of hundreds of billions of dollars of people who everyone will then say, I have bad body image because of this. I've had depression and suicidal thoughts.
Wow.
So this is Zuckerberg and Instagram and YouTube. They know. And by the way, last thought, Snapchat and TikTok settled.
They settled.
They didn't want to. Yeah, they didn't want to go through with this. They were afraid. They said, here's a check. Go away.
Hey, that works with me, Thane. Here's a check. Give me the check. Go away. Thane Rosenbaum, CBS News. Thane, as always, thanks, man. We appreciate it.
Thanks, buddy.
All right, thanks. Hey, works for me. Here's the check. I'll go away. So you know how I often say this, and you may think I say it in jest, but I'm serious about it, even though what I say may sound tongue-in-cheek. There are times, kids, boys and girls, where I don't think we are governed by serious people. I mean, I'm sure they're nice people. I'm sure they're well-intentioned. But many of those in Hartford who, and don't get me wrong, those in Hartford from the governor on down have much, 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 much more an effect on your daily lives and your life over there and your life over here, and you over there, and me, than anything that happens in the White House and anything that happens in Congress. I mean, think about it. Think about it. Joe Biden, Barack Obama, Bill Clinton, Donald Trump, even with Donald Trump in comparison to all this, how different is your life really depending on who's in the White House? Not really. Yeah. Taxes may get adjusted here and there. Yeah, we may go after some snot-nosed international dictator here and there, but little by little, kind of whoever's in the White House or whomever's in the White House, it really, when you think about it, as the years go on, make much less of an impression on our daily lives than who governs us in Hartford. In the governor's office, in the lieutenant governor's office, in the Attorney General's office, yada, 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 and the people in the General Assembly. Now, the reason I say some of these people in the General Assembly are nice people, and I've had many of them on here, many of them, especially in the Democratic leadership, are not serious people. What do I mean? Well, today's big story coming out of Hartford is this. Now, as the dust hasn't even settled yet on a big public hearing we had yesterday on the Senate Bill 151, which will follow up for you. I promise I keep an eye on these big bills and let you know what's happening. Well, I've got to let you know about this. From the where should I say this comes from? From the you cannot be serious wing of the leadership in Hartford. And the scary thing is, this is one of those things that when you hear it, you're like, hey, Paul, how can you be against that? Well, I'm not against the core issue here, what we're about to talk about. But let's get down to the dirty, nitty-gritty details, shall we? This story here, courtesy of the Connecticut Post and Austin Mermina. Thank you, Austin. Lawmakers in Hartford are considering a bill. Now, other states have done this. I think Massachusetts and New York have done this. I think, hey, so why not us? Or as the judge used to sing, why not me? Connecticut lawmakers are looking at a bill that would create a here are the two words that should make you bury your face in the palms of your hands, kids. A proposed law would create a, here it is, climate superfund. There's two words you love to see together. Cha-ching. Cha-ching. Oh, wait, put the cash draw in here. So some legislators in Hartford want to create a climate superfund that would require major fossil fuel companies to help pay for, get this now, can you be any more broad than this? They want the fossil fuel companies to help pay for the costs of adapting to climate change. Can you be any broader than that? Wow. Hey, it's costing me to adapt the climate change. This comes from the General Assembly's Environment Committee. It would force, now get this, and I think you know where I'm going here, because 98% of you have common sense out there other than the some people in the leadership in Hartford that don't. The proposal would force, as in you have no choice, I guess, certain oil, coal, and gas companies to compensate the state for their role in emitting large amounts of climate-warming greenhouse gases. The money would fund projects aimed at protecting communities from climate-related hazards that are becoming more common, like floods and heat waves. I don't know. How is a company paying into a climate fund going to protect people from a heat wave? Can somebody explain that to me? Or protect communities from a flood? Now, you may say, well, Paul, what's wrong with this? Don't we want to be ready and react to climate change? Of course we do. I'm not saying the climate isn't changing. The climate changes all the time. We've only been recording temperatures for about 300 years, maybe the 16, the 1700s, whatever. We seem to think we know a lot more than all of a sudden new studies come out and say, well, maybe we didn't know this. But that's not the issue here. The issue is, let me ask you something, folks. And you can let me know what your thoughts are, whether you think I'm being a jerk on this or whether you kind of, you know, kind of see my point on this, whether you want to admit it or not. Who's going to pay for this? I mean, the minute you hear the word, and I'm telling you, and again, part of what I love doing here is keeping you, my dear friends and listeners, informed on everything that's going on when I get paid to watch this and you don't have to, because you have real jobs, you're taking care of your families, and I don't want you to have to on election day and say, hey, where the heck did this come from, Paul? So I'm telling you. So listen, you had better be really deathly afraid of the words climate superfund. Taken individually, they're bad enough. Put them together, oh man, climate superfund. Again, climate superfund. Guess where the superfund comes from and the money comes from in a super way? The idea of creating a climate superfund, continuing in the story here, has become a hotly contested issue with the Capitol, stirring debate and beyond. Supporters say it would hold corporate polluters accountable for climate-related damages already felt. Industry groups say it could further drive up. What a shock! The industry groups are saying, hey, it's just going to drive up our costs and your prices, which are, I don't know whether you knew this, Connecticut, every time an Eversource person or a UI person opens their bill, they take it right up the rear because we're the second or third highest electric rates in the nation. So what do the not serious people in the General Assembly want to do? Make you pay more money. Well, Paul, how do you know these costs are going to get passed on to the consumer? Come on. Come on, please. What color's the sky in your world? You do know the sun rises in the east and sets in the west. And the Pope is Catholic and a bear, yes, in the woods. 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. So I ask you, and there's already people chiming in on this today, on facebook.com/voiceofct and or our text messaging page, same number, talk or text, 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. So what do you think? Do you support a proposed Connecticut climate superfund? It's a bird, it's a plane, no, out of the sky, able to leap tall buildings at a single bound, it's a climate superfund. That would force big fuel companies to help pay for the costs connected to climate change. You okay with that? Maybe you are. You okay with it, even if it's you and I that have to pay? Because you know that's happening, right? You know. What do you think? These companies are charities? No. Many of them have shareholders. They've got to pay a dividend here. They lose a lot of their capital. People sell the shares and cash out. What do you think? Climate Superfund, you on board with this? Or is this just another Midtown Manhattan three-card Monty game on the corner? Traffic and weather together right here on WICC. Are you ready for your utility bills to go up even more? Well, how do you know that, Paul? What are you scaring us? Well, listen, sometimes you need to be scared. What's that old phrase? I know a lot of athletic coaches use it. Fear is life's greatest motivator. Like, you know, you may not make the opening day roster, kid. You may not survive the final cut. And that would be done even if a coach knew that he or she was going to keep you, you know, on the squad. They might say, hey, coach, am I going to make it? I don't know. You better check the list tomorrow at 3 o'clock. Let us know. So, again, should you be fearful that your utility bills may go up? Yeah, they might. Again, they might go up again. Because there are some people in the Democratic leadership at Hartford and these committee chairs, because you know there's no Republicans that want this. Are you kidding me? So there is word that a climate superfund would be set up. Now, the EPA on the federal level, you hear about the Environmental Protection Agency's superfund, and that's been a pool of money that was established way back in 1980 that states dip into all the time, and Congress has to allocate money toward to clean up. And you still hear about superfund sites, right? After, you know, from the turn of the century, when the turn of last century, I should say, 1800s into the 1900s, where, you know, you went from an agrarian society with horse crap on the streets, ankle deep in some spots, as my mom and dad and grandmother and grandfather used to tell me in Greater New Haven. Hence the old term, he's all around the neighborhood like horse, right? Well, we segued from that into an industrial age that unfortunately didn't have a whole lot of environmental regulations. Oh, acids, lead, put it in the river. Oh, just dump it in the marsh there. It'll break up. No. Who doesn't like a good acid cocktail every so often? No, we've gotten beyond that. But are we going too far here? Remember Love Canal? They talked about, it's mentioned in the story here, the Love Canal disaster. So what Connecticut wants to do is, rather than targeting contamination at specific sites, and we hear about this a lot in Bridgeport, right, with some of these old industrial sites that need to get cleaned up before you have new retail put in there or housing or whatever, you hear about these specific cleanup sites. Connecticut wants to, at least some legislators want to, including the Sierra Club, they want to seek to recover costs associated with damage from global warming more broadly. So again, here we go again. They want to do a broad. What is broad, actually? Well, you know, the classic, hey, look at that broad. I'm kidding. Relax. It's a joke. My God. But when you should, folks, I am telling you, when you see Climate Superfund when you see Climate Superfund and anything done on a broad basis, hide your wallets, hide your Venmo accounts, hide your checking and savings accounts, because they're coming after it. Now, get this. Now, here's where it gets a little sticky here. In fact, you know what? We'll do this on the other side of the news here, because now you get into the weeds with some of this stuff. So listen, we all want a clean environment, right? Nobody wants slop in the water. Nobody wants chemicals on the ground. We benefit from a clean environment. But please, once again, as the great Aretha Franklin used to sing, who's zooming who, babe? Stop saying, well, the companies are going to pay for it. Yeah, they may write the first check. Where do they collect that money? If you think these companies aren't going to go back and recover the money in their prices, you're out of your minds. So what we should be asking here, maybe I've worded the question wrong. I don't know. Are you okay with your energy costs going up to repair damage from climate change and to get ready for further climate change events? Like heat waves. I don't know. How is you and I paying anything going to prevent a heat wave? And listen, I tell this of lawmakers all the time in Hartford, whether rhetorically here or when I have them on the phone here, as we will later on. Just be honest with us. Don't say, well, you know, the companies are going to pay, and the big companies. And no, that's you and I. You may think that's okay. So I'll come back and continue the verbal twister on this. But you tell me at 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. How do you feel about this? Do you support a proposed climate superfund? It's a bird, it's a plane, it's superfund. That would force some big fuel companies to help pay for costs connected to climate change. You buying into that? Or is this just mass hysteria continued right here?